Welcome to Catholic Morality and the Catechism. Monsignor William Smith talks about things our society would sometimes rather not discuss. Moral conscience, virtues, and the Ten Commandments. Here's Monsignor Smith.
Hello, I'm Monsignor Bill Smith, a professor of moral theology at St. Joseph Seminary, Dunwoody, which is the seminary for the Archdiocese of New York. Our series here concerns the moral teaching of the Church, but the moral teaching as found in the Catechism, this Catechism of the Catholic Church. That's part three of the Catechism. In our first segment, we reviewed a little bit the place and the structure of the moral teaching in the Catechism. Its roots and foundations are in divine revelation, Holy Scripture, Church's sacred tradition. Then we looked at some fundamental points, because the moral part is divided into two sections, one on fundamentals, the smaller part, and then all the specifics, some of which we will try to examine later. We looked at the purpose in life, the goal in life. We have to know where we're going before you can figure out what's good for getting you there. The last time we also considered what's technically called a human act. A human act, which is the basis of a moral act, is one that proceeds from your will with a knowledge of the end, so that both of those components, a volitional component involving our will and a knowledge involving our intellect. This time I'd like to focus on what's technically called the sources of morality, or sometimes the factors. When we say that some kind of activity is a good kind of activity or a bad kind of activity, on what basis do we make that statement? What's relevant? What's included? What factors or components are relevant for saying this of any kind of human activity? Here again, we're considering a fundamental concept, so we're not asking in a specific case, a conscience case, whether when Joe Blow ripped off or robbed the local bank, whether or not he had sufficient freedom and knowledge. But what we'd be looking for here is, why do we consider robbery a bad kind of act? Why do we consider telling the truth a good kind of act? And this is what we call the sources. What sources, what fonts, what factors, what elements are helpful in constructing this understanding of morality? So that here, again, in the Catechism, it's a very short section in the fundamental part, 1749 to 1775, and it presents the traditional teaching of the Church in this matter about the kind of activity, about the place of intentionality, and about relevant circumstances. But we want to, it might be hard to accept this, but it's actually in this area, the area of ethical principle or ethical theory, where an awful lot of the civil wars within the Church over the last 20, 25 years have actually been fought. Some of it, sometimes people make, an overly simple thing, like they accuse the Church's teaching of being physicalistic, or if it happens to deal with the human body or human sexuality, they'll call it biogelistic, as if it was sheer biology. And that's not really true. Morality cannot be reduced merely to a photograph, merely a photograph. For instance, if you had a picture, if you had a photo of someone taking a very sharp instrument, kind of penetrating my abdomen, could you tell me from that photograph alone, morally, what's going on here? And actually, that would not be immediately clear. I mean, if I had appendicitis and it were a doctor removing a diseased appendix, we could call that a moral kind of action. If it's a mugger trying to relieve me of the contents of my wallet, that would be a radically different kind. But both could be using a sharp instrument, right? So in a sense, you can't really tell from a physical picture the real morality of something. And it is the considered and consistent teaching of St. Thomas Aquinas that the same physical action can admit of different moral specifications. They can admit. For instance, if someone leaped off a four-story building, from the roof of a four-story building, and they leaped because the place was on fire and they couldn't go down the stairwell, and the only way left was to leap toward the rescue people. That would be, we could call that an escape. They're escaping a fire. If someone else were to leap from the same height, from the same fourth floor roof, because they just found out that all their CDs had become worthless and their money had disappeared, and they heard Sophie Tucker say once, I've been rich and I've been poor and I like rich better, and they didn't want to live this way anymore, and it's the same leap from the same height to the same spot on the ground, those would morally be two very, very different actions, although physically they're the same action. So we don't want to reduce morality merely to the physical, but we can't prescind from the physical either. We can't pretend it's not part, because after all, there is no murder unless there's a killing, and yet not every killing is a murder. There is no false speech or perjury unless there is some speech in the first place, and yet not all speech is perjury. So there's a connection. So moral actions are rooted in physical actions, but it's involved, more is involved, and that's what this addresses here. When we say the facts, the fontes, the elements, the components, what is it about a moral action that helps specify why we call it a good kind of action or a bad kind of action? And the first thing we look for, the Catechism says in number 1751, is what they call the object of an action. Now, again, that's the moral object, not just the physical taking, not just the physical taking. If you had some, if it went back to the photograph, and you had a photograph of someone kind of removing a television from someone's room, from their apartment, from their house, you couldn't tell from the photograph necessarily what's going on there. I mean, if they had the owner's permission, something had to be fixed down at the shop, and he's acting in accord with the will of the owner, that could be the fulfillment of a just contract and a business dealing. Nothing wrong with that. If, of course, the guy was stealing it against the reasonable will of the owner. So it's the same physical action admits of different moral specification. Now, again, we say, is there anything about an action itself that has some linkage, some bearing, some relevance on a norm of morality external to itself? True, we haven't gotten to the norm of morality in the Catechism. We will. Externally, it'll be called law. Internally, it would be called conscience. But it's this first thing that is really part of a philosophy of realism, that actions are specified by their objects. Actions are specified by their objects. So we first look at the moral object of an action. For example, stealing. We call stealing a taking against the reasonable will of the owner. Any taking against the reasonable will of the owner would be at odds with what we would call the seventh commandment, thou shalt not steal. Now, not every taking is a stealing, but every taking against the reasonable will of the owner is a stealing. That makes the kind of act that it is. And that's why we would say stealing as a kind of act is a wrong kind of act, whereas paying your just debts is a good kind of act. Like telling the truth is a good kind of act. Perjury, we say, is a bad kind of act, as a kind of act. The question really is there anything intrinsic, inherent, part of the action itself, which has a link, a bearing, on some norm of rule or morals that helps specify the kind of act it is in its moral estimation? And that's what the Catechism teaches. It says this is the matter of a human act that specifies it. And this, of course, is our only link with objective morality. But that's not the only thing, the kind of act it is. Now, when we say philosophically actions are specified by their objects, that might sound kind of mysterious, but it's not. If you want to make a phone call, you don't go into the shower and turn on the cold faucet. And again, if you want to take a shower, you normally don't pick up the phone and hold it over your head. That type of activity is irrational. It has no connection with what you're doing, with what you're trying to achieve. Whereas actions are truly specified. And when I say stealing, you know I'm not holding the phone over my head. And when we say perjury, you know you're not taking the hubcaps off a car. And so the object of the action specifies it, if you will, in its moral estimation, this linkage, this connection, the hook, a link with some norm or rule of morals. That's the first thing we look at. What kind of an act is it? All right. Now, besides that, there's also what we call the circumstances of an action. Circumstance in English comes from a Latin circum, stantia. These are the things that stand around an action. They are like the properties rather than its essence. And a moral action can either be aggravated or diminished. It can be increased or diminished according to circumstances. For instance, if somebody stole something by really using violence and they just twisted someone's arm or put a knife to their neck to relieve them of $50, we'd call that theft. What if someone relieved someone else of $50, but through a tricky argument sold them the Brooklyn Bridge? Now, you may say this can never happen, but I'm told the Brooklyn Bridge has been sold many, many times over, as has the Golden Gate, sometimes at a discount rate. The other is just as fraudulent. It's a taking, but it's kind of a clever one. Used force, one did not. It still remains, morally, the kind of act it is, theft. But the circumstances, in one case we say it's worse, because it's aggravated. In the other we say it's lessened, but it's still a wrong kind of act. For instance, again, we could say maybe you had a little scenario where an 18-year-old fella was taking a bat and attacking a 46-year-old man. And he was not parting his hair. He was actually assaulting him. This would clearly be a violation of the Fifth Commandment. What if we said, circumstantially, this 18-year-old happened to be the son of the 46-year-old? Is that a mere circumstance? Does that change the nature of what's going on here morally? And in that case, we'd say yes, because not only is this a violation of the Fifth Commandment, unjust force against violence against another human person, but clearly this would be against the Fourth Commandment, because whatever honor your mother and father means, beating someone over the head with a baseball bat is not a form of honor. It is not an honorific action. So circumstances kind of answer the questions that we say adverbs. How, when, where, under what circumstances. And they can aggravate or diminish the morality of a kind of act, but they cannot change one if it already has a moral determination. The third component, the third element, is the person's intention. The person's intention. What did he or she intend? Now again, obviously, this is not part of the action. This is extrinsic to it, by definition. This comes from the agent himself or herself, not from the act. Say, for instance, you have somebody, a very dutiful son. His mother is sick. She's in the hospital. He doesn't have any available cash, so he steals $50 to buy flowers for his mother, who's in the hospital. Now, you could say, is his intention a generous one? Well, if it's to cheer up his mother, yes. But does that make it a correct action? And we would say no, because that good end, that good purpose, that generous, well, seemingly generous remark on his part to cheer up his mother, that will not change the kind of act that he employs to get to that good end. And that's what backs us up against what is really a biblical principle, that the end does not justify the means. The end does not justify the means. It's there in Romans 3:8. At one point, some folks asked St. Paul a question. Why not do a little evil so that more good can come about? So that more good can come about. And St. Paul says very clearly in Romans 3:8, no, no. No, no. Such people will be condemned as they deserve. All right, now we try to put these three things together. The kind of act that it is, in its moral estimation, the relevant moral circumstances, the factors that surround this kind of action, and the individual personal intention. Now here we must admit, as the Catechism says, but maybe not fully enough, when all of these factors are good, only then can we call an act a good kind of act. If any one of them is wrong or deficient, we cannot call it a good kind of act. Now, here we must admit, this is a more challenging theory than some other theories. The two most prevalent theories, ethical theories, moral theories, are, at least in the United States, one theory is connected with Immanuel Kant. It's called ethical formalism. And the fulcrum on which all moral judgments rest for Kant is really the uprightness of an upright intention. All that matters for Kant is the purity of your intention. So if you have a good intention, then it's got to be a good kind of act. If you have a bad intention, then it's got to be a bad kind of act. And that's why that approach, ethical formalism, formal being non-material, Kant doesn't pay any attention to consequences. He doesn't pay any attention to circumstances, just the uprightness of the upright intention. Many Germans would have it in their theory. It's the old thing on duty for duty's sake. Not that you'll get a reward, not that it's good consequences or bad consequences, but just duty for duty's sake. Okay. That's one element. A different one, which is all circumstances and all consequences, is connected with the theory, the ethical theory of John Stuart Mill. We call that utilitarianism. Now, this is very prevalent in our country. This is very prevalent in the United States. I think it's endemic in almost all of us who speak English. If English is our native tongue, there's a little utilitarianism buried in our genes. I think we're wired that way. We are pragmatic people. And pragmatic people pay attention to consequences and they pay attention to results. And very often in the political order, there's not much else you can do except approach things this way. And their argument will be, look, if it brings about more good consequences than bad consequences, then it's a good kind of act. If it brings about more bad consequences than good consequences, then it's a bad kind of act. Notice what they're saying. The action itself has no morality. It all depends on consequences. So if the consequences or resultancies add up to a lot more negatives than positives, then it's a bad kind of act and not really choice-worthy. On the other hand, if it brings about more good than evil, then it's a good kind of act. Now, the classical problem with utilitarianism, give the devil his due. Utilitarianism is a very efficient system. You could probably solve any practical problem in this country in less than 48 hours if utilitarianism was the only way to approach things, because it is efficient. It is efficient. And we have it now in speech and in common reference. A lot of people talk about a cost-benefit analysis. You kind of add up the costs and the benefits. If you come out with more benefits than costs, then it's worth it. If you end up with more costs than benefits, then it's too expensive. It's not worth it. Now, this may be a wonderful technique for clarifying advantages and disadvantages, but it's not a good technique at all for clarifying or figuring out what's right and wrong. In the Catholic understanding, in this little section in the Catechism, 1749 to 1775, it points out and challenges us that we have to look at all three factors. The kind of action it is, in its morally relevant description, the circumstances that surround it or the consequences we unleash, and the person's individual intention. The teaching of St. Thomas is basically goodness comes from the integrity, from the fullness of these sources. So they all have to be good for us to say that telling the truth is a good kind of act. Because a good kind of act, for a wrong kind of reason, can be spoiled. And then a bad kind of act, I mean, this is where we get our notion of intrinsic morality. Something like adultery, something like perjury, even for the best of reasons, it cannot not be what it is. I know that's a double negative, and I think the sisters taught me as a child not to use double negatives. But my point is basically, when we use a wrong means to accomplish some good personal end, that means that act does not cease being what it is. And we have to admit, this is more challenging. It's harder. If all we had to do was to pay attention to good and generous intentions, well, then let us, by all means, come up with good, generous intentions. If, on the other hand, we were utilitarians and all we had to do was add up the consequences, see whether more good comes than evil, then that's the approach. That, of course, has some inherent problems as well, because how do you add up goods? How do you weigh them? I mean, how long are they? How heavy are they? You can measure facts, I suppose, but it's very difficult to measure goods. So this is why the Catechism will say that first we look at the object, the kind of act that it is in its moral specification. Then secondly, the intention, which is in the deciding subject, you or me, when we make decisions, when we decide. And it says very clearly in 1753 that a good intention, for example, helping one's neighbor, does not make behavior that is intrinsically disordered, such as lying or calumny, good or just. The end doesn't justify the means. The end does not justify the means. I've repeated that over and over because that's really a cardinal principle of true Christian morality. Now, what it means, of course, is that a good end does not justify a wrong means to that end. Obviously, a good end with a good means, that's not a problem. But it's important that a good reason, a good intention, a good purpose does not, never has, never will justify a wrong means to accomplish that intention, to accomplish that good goal. And we should admit quite candidly, that's a stricter principle than some other approaches. So that we look at all of these elements in their context, and then we try to sum it up, as they do in the last two numbers in that section, numbers 1755 and 1756. Because it's on this basis that we actually begin to talk about good kinds of acts and evil kinds of acts. Not specific ones where a conscience exam is concerned, but why and on what basis do we make general statements about human behavior that have some observable meaning verified by our own personal experience? And they sum it up by saying a morally good act requires the goodness of the object, the kind of act it is, the personal intention, and the circumstances. Because the object of choice by itself can vitiate an action. It says very clearly there are some concrete acts. They give example, fornication, that are always wrong. Just like direct abortion is always wrong. Direct euthanasia is always wrong. The kind of act it is cannot be conformed, cannot be, if you will, the act is bent. So it really can't lead us to the end of life, which is union with God. Even if it's a good intention. Even if our short-term assessment of consequences, you know, this will eliminate grief from my life. But there are certain kinds of acts in themselves which are never choice-worthy for a Christian. And that involves us in the notion of some intrinsic morality. Now, this is what we call the level of moral principle. By definition, it's probably, at first, a kind of boring section. Not just the subject, but the one who is boring you now. But remember, tiny little changes in principle can have gigantic consequences in actual practice. I said before, most of the civil wars within the church on moral theory, moral theology, have been fought over this under the name of consequentialism or proportionalism. The Catechism here is very concise. The Holy Father's encyclical Veritatis Splendor, which in large part is easy to read until you get to numbers 71 to 83. Where you have the most detailed explanation of this moral object, moral intention, and moral circumstances that I've ever seen in any formal church teaching. And the Holy Father goes at that very, very carefully. But he comes to the same conclusion. He said, it's an error to judge that the morality of human acts, simply by looking only at the intention that inspires them, or only at the circumstances or consequences or resultancies that come about. Because, in fact, there are actions in themselves, independent of circumstance and intention, that are always gravely illicit by reason of their object. Catechism mentions blasphemy, perjury, murder, and adultery. This is what we call intrinsic morality. And although it does have a philosophical basis and it does have a biblical root, it's important because this notion of an objective referent, an objective morality, are very, very important. If we shift in the other direction, as some consequentialists or proportionalists have argued, we must realize what we're doing is we're moving to a subjective type of morality, because after all, it's the subject, you or me, who's going to add up all these consequences. Well, then you decide for you and I'll decide for me. It's also relativistic. Some goods are going to measure more than others. It is also kind of extrinsic. We're saying that there's nothing in the actions themselves that has any bearing on a norm or rule of morality. It all depends on the intention of the deciding subject or the consequences that are appreciated by the deciding subject. So for that reason, in the brief section that sums it up, 1757 through 1761, you should try to coordinate this one with the section of the encyclical Veritatis Splendor, number 71 to 83, because it's important. But let's just say it's the integrity, it's the fullness of all the relevant factors, the kind of act that it is, the individual personal intention, and also the circumstances. When all of them are good, that's what we mean by a good kind of act.
Join us again next time for Catholic Morality and the Catechism on EWTN Global Catholic Radio.